Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, we are honored and excited tonight to have T.C. Boyle back at the Tattered Cover with his new book, The Harder They Fall. What? Oh, no. Oh, my goodness. I thought, why is everyone reacting? Oh, my God. See that? Oh, my gosh. I wrote it that way, too. That's the worst part. It is called, his new book, The Harder They Come, which makes sense, actually. This really is one of those books you cannot put down. A contemporary story about a retired couple who have a troubled adult son. And the parents, of course, both love and worry about him. He hooks up with a young woman who's actually 15 years his senior, who works with horses, kind of a colorful character, and life changes for him, too, when he hooks up with her. She is part of a right-wing anarchist group as well. So, as many of you here tonight know, T.C. Boyles has won numerous literary awards for his 14 novels and his 10 collections of short stories, including the Penn Faulkner, the 2014 Henry David Thoreau Award for Nature Writing, and the Penn Malamud Prize for Short Story. Well, we all have our favorite T.C. Boyle novels and books. The special one that we really can't forget, Tortilla Curtain, San Miguel, The Road to Wellville, When the Killing is Done, East is East, and I won't go on, but most all of those are on the back bookshelf along with the new book. And now, without further ado, will you please join me in welcoming T.C. Boyle?
Well, thanks. Thanks, folks. And Marty, your slip is okay because the harder they come, the harder they fall. That's the phrase. That's the phrase, and that's the key element of this book. So, hello, all you Denverites and Tattered Coverians. It is a joy and an honor to be here tonight. And I'm not just shining you on. This is the last engagement of a 23-city tour that has lasted 5 weeks. And I've been to L.A. three times and New York twice during this 23-city tour. It's really tough on my wife, poor Frau Boyle. There's no one to clean up after her if I'm not there. So I look forward to going back tomorrow with a pitchfork just to get in the kitchen door. So I have an artifact here for you. I'm very jealous of you, all of you, by the way. This artifact I brought with me from the Santa Barbara Historical Museum. Can you see it back there? Yep. Yep. That's the shape we're in, folks. I should never have written A Friend of the Earth. None of this would have happened. And I shouldn't have predicted to 2026 about global warming. I should have predicted till now, sadly. Anyway, we're in the fourth year of the drought. You may have heard that Jerry Brown has imposed a mandatory 25% reduction on everybody in the state. Well, where I live, in my little town, which is contiguous to Santa Barbara, we've been on a 30% reduction since February a year ago. And it has been very, very tough. My wife and I bathe once a week together in the bathtub. Then we wash the clothes in there, and what's left, we boil the spaghetti and throw on the rose bush. So it's been tough. We've just gone through our fourth consecutive rainless, rainy season, and it is really getting to be a drag. I'm a nature boy, as you know, and I have a sort of, my yard is a kind of nature preserve. I dug a pond for the creatures. I planted a lot of milkweed, and I advise you all to do it. The monarchs will come. It's a beautiful thing. And I'm trying to keep that stuff alive. A lawn, I haven't had a lawn for years. It's just dirt because what a waste of water. So I know we steal your water. I know we do. But we want more of it. Yeah. I came through from Steamboat Springs today, up at 12,000 feet through the pass, help me out, Burthen? Yeah, the rabbit ears and the Burthen Pass. God, it was beautiful. Lots of snow up there. So, all right. So, as Marty has told you, I'm here with The Harder They Come, The Harder They Fall. This is my meditation on American gun violence, and not the sort of thing that's going on in the African-American community or Latino community among gangs, but specifically the trial that's going on here now, for instance, the lone white, almost always white gunman who is a disaffected young man, often with mental problems, liberally supplied with guns thanks to the NRA, who goes out and hates society so much he wants to take as many of us with him as he can. And I focused on one particular story that I discovered from 2011 in Fort Bragg, Northern California. This is an old lumbering town up in the Redwood Forests, a couple hours north of San Francisco. And I have fictionalized this account, but I'm following very closely this 50-page police report. Again, I'm not a journalist, so I don't – of course, I've gone to Fort Bragg on several occasions and sniffed around to get it, make it authentic. But, you know, I don't interview the police chief. I don't know the people involved. I'm just imagining a scenario from this report and other press reports. You know, the press report tells us who did what to whom, but it doesn't say why. It doesn't get inside the head. So in this book, I give you three – central characters with a very close third-person point of view of each. The first, as Marty told you, is Sten Stenson. He is a senior citizen who has gone to, in my telling, to Costa Rica with a group of senior citizens on a cruise. And from that, they go on a bus to go to a nature preserve. The bus is held up by three armed assailants, young men. Sten, a former Marine, 70 years old, reacts instinctively and grabs the guy with the gun and puts him in a chokehold. But he can't stop. He winds up killing the guy. The other two run away. This is also based on a true story from a few years back. He is then heralded as a hero in the press. And when he goes back to Fort Bragg, everyone, you know, he's sitting in a restaurant, people send free drinks over, that sort of thing. And he is of two minds about what has happened. You know, is it self-defense or has he gone too far, etc.? The second character, whom I will introduce you to tonight, is Sarah Havarti Jennings. She's 40, as you'll find out. She's a farrier, and she's a member of the Sovereign Citizens Movement, which is a right-wing anarchist group that doesn't believe in any governmental authority and has a whole bizarre rationale from the Uniform Commercial Code to prove why they don't have to pay taxes or have license plates and so on. And, you know, I can don't know you that well, but I'm looking at you, and I know how much you probably all enjoyed paying your taxes 2 weeks ago. I love it. I love to pay my taxes. But they don't, conveniently. And again, as this book evolved, I began to think, with Sarah involved, it's about this anti-authoritarianism that we all have, this streak of the American character. It's part of us. You know, we're taught from elementary school on to be skeptical of authority, to think independently, to stand up for ourselves, etc. But I'm wondering, where does that destroy the society, and where do we agree to respect each other's freedoms and be part of a society? The third character is Adam, the son. And shortly after Sten returns, his son, who has been very squirrely and living, can't live with his parents anymore. He's 25. He's delusional. He's not taking his meds. He doesn't go to the shrink anymore. He is living with his grandmother near the Noyo River. Then she dies. So he's there alone. And he wants to be a mountain man and live off nature and live in nature. And so he shoots two people and then becomes a hunted man. And in the real story, this was the greatest manhunt in California history back in 2011. He was at large for 5 weeks because he was a kind of mountain man, survivalist. He knew this area. He grew up there. All the SWAT teams, the dogs, the helicopters, the infrared cameras, they couldn't catch him. So I'm writing from his point of view. All three of the characters are probably alien to my readers, but I think if I've done my job properly, you will see from their point of view why they're doing what they're doing, and I hope even have sympathy for them. So I have two choices tonight. I could read you the opening part, which you may have read in Harper's last month, which is extremely dramatic and involves Sten actually killing this young man. But I'm not going to do that because I don't want to bum you out and send you home miserable, angry at the world. I'm going to read you the introduction to Sarah instead. This is not a comedic book, and yet you will find this section humorous, I think. And that's because point of view allows you to see the difference between the way she thinks, this sovereign citizen, and the way most of the rest of us normal people think. So here she is. She didn't like fast food, or not particularly. The grease they used hardened your arteries, and they doused everything with corn syrup and sugar, which jacked up the calories and made you put on weight. An issue with her. She knew it. But she stopped at the place on Route 20 in Willits and got a crispy chicken sandwich, if only to put something on her stomach. It wasn't like her to oversleep. But that's what had happened, and she'd had to skip breakfast and run out the door with nothing but a cup of yesterday's coffee microwaved to an angry boil, and she still wound up being half an hour late for her morning appointment. As a concession to the little voice nagging in her head, she skipped the fries and ordered a diet drink instead of regular, though she did ask for crispy instead of grilled because grilled had no more taste than warmed over cardboard with a spatter of ketchup on it. Her dog, Kucha, was in the back seat, generally behaving himself, but he came to attention when she pulled into the drive-through lane. He must have recognized the place, if not by sight, then smell, though she hadn't stopped here more than a handful of times. At any rate, he began whining and tap-dancing around on the seat. He'd rendered filthy despite the towel she'd spread over it, and she gave in and ordered him a burger. No bun, no condiments, no pickles. Feeding it to him over her shoulder as she put the trusty blue Nissan Sentra into drive and sailed on out of the lot and down the long, winding road to Fort Bragg and the coast. There was talk on the radio, but it was mainly left-wing communist crap, NPR, and how was it their signal was stronger than anybody else's? And even that faded out once she started down the grade and hit the first few switchbacks. So she popped in a CD instead. She favored country, but the old stuff. The classic stuff, Loretta and Merle and Hank, because all the new singers with their custom-made boots and blow-dried hair were just pale imitators in any case. And if people criticized her for being a once-divorced 40-year-old woman with no romantic prospects on the horizon who really wasn't in step with the times, you mean not even Brad Paisley? So much the worse. She liked what she liked. And when she went out on a Saturday night with her best friend Christabel Walsh, had a few beers, she just let the music wash right over her like the vapid stares of all the losers lined up at the bar who were too small-minded and self-absorbed to ask a woman to dance. No matter. She dwelled within herself. She was content and self-sufficient. She had her own business. She had Kucha, a rented two-bedroom clapboard house that looked down on the crotch of the Noyo Valley, and half the horses in the world available to her anytime she wanted to ride. If another relationship came along, fine. If not, too bad for him, or them, whoever they might be. Because she wasn't desperate. Not in the least. Not even close. And there was no way in the world she was going to pretend to like Brad Paisley or whoever, because to her, it was all just more of the same sing-song bastardized crap. And she told Christabel that, and she'd tell anybody else who might want to stick their nose in, too. So there she was, driving in her own personal property with her dog by her side and a living to earn, winding down Route 20 so she could get to the Coast Highway and head 44.5 miles south to the little fly-speck town of Calpurnia, where there were three horses that needed her ministrations. It was the middle of the summer. The sky was clear, the sun fixed like a compass point ahead of her. When she looped around a turn and saw the coast off in the distance, it was clear there, too. The fog burned back and exiled in a linty gray band out at sea. Was she wearing her seatbelt? No, she wasn't. And she was never going to wear it either. Seatbelt laws were just another contrivance of the U.S. illegitimate government of America, the corporate that had given up the gold standard back in 1933 and pledged its citizens as collateral so it could borrow and keep on borrowing. But she wasn't a citizen of the USIGA. She was a sovereign citizen, a U.S. national, born and raised, and she didn't now and never would again acknowledge anybody's illegitimate authority over her. So no, she wasn't wearing her seatbelt. And she didn't have legal plates, or the sort of plates the Republic of California deemed legal. The sticker that had come with the ones on the car was long since expired because she wasn't about to play that game. And if she was traveling on the public roads in her own personal property, it was her business and nobody else's. When the cop pulled her over, he claimed it was because she wasn't wearing her seatbelt. But, of course, he would have had to have raptor's eyes to see that from 300 feet away, where he was fooling nobody behind a roadside clump of madrone, except maybe the drifting black vultures overhead. She'd watched him swing out behind her, pulling a U-turn and settling in on her tail with his gumball machine spinning and his siren whoop, whoop, whooping. She might have gone half a mile or more before she finally pulled over, in a spot at the mouth of a dirt drive that seemed sufficiently safe. The whole road to this point bristling with jagged pines and dried-up weeds that snatched at the side of the car every time she drifted toward the shoulder. Looking back on it, she supposed she could have stopped sooner, and she supposed, too, that that might have had something to do with this particular cop's agitation. But you did what you did, and you couldn't have regrets, not in this life that just marched you on toward the grave day by day. He was lean, young, fresh-faced. He had to tap at the window 3 times before she rolled it down. Kucha lurched forward to give him a low warning growl, and then he was barking. And she didn't do a thing about it. Let him bark. That was what she felt. It was his right. "Do you know why I stopped you, ma'am?" the cop said. Of course she did. He was the oppressor, and she was the oppressed. She said nothing. "License and registration," the cop said, raising his voice to be heard over the clamor of the dog, "and proof of insurance." What she told him in response, in a voice as steady as she could hold it, even as Kucha settled into a ragged, gasping, continuous, low-throated bark, and people slowed to gape at her as if she were some circus attraction, was that she was not engaged in a contract with the Republic of California. "I'm a sovereign citizen," she said, speaking as clearly as she could, given the noise of the dog and the clank and hiss of the traffic, as all the white-haired baby boomer tourists applied their brakes and then stepped back on the gas once they'd got a good look. "You have no authority over me." The cop just stared at her. After a moment, he flipped up his sunglasses so she could see the fine red fissures of irritation fracturing his frog-belly eyes. "Maybe you didn't hear me," he said, "but I asked for your license and registration." She said nothing. Just fixed her gaze straight ahead to where the road ran on into the sunshine, past a field of stiff yellow grass and a shadowy fringe of trees, the road that ran true to her destination, to the place where she had business, when she had no business here at all. "Ma'am?" She turned her head back to him, locked her eyes on his, and her heart was going all right because she could tell where this was leading, and it scared her, and it made the anger come up in her too, and why couldn't they just leave well enough alone? "I told you," she said. "I have no contract with you." "Does that mean you refuse?" "Let me repeat. I have no contract with you." He shifted his boots in the gravel along the roadside, a dull, grating, intolerable sound that got Kucha back up into the high register. The cop put his hands on his hips as if to show her where the gun was and the nightstick and handcuffs, too. He said, "I'm going to have to ask you to step out of the car." "No," she said, "I won't." "Suit yourself." He straightened up then and stalked back to his car, where she could see him in her rear view as he leaned in, pulled out the cord of the radio mic, and started moving his lips. 10 long minutes crept by. Each one of them, each second, dripped acid through her veins, and she thought of just putting the car in gear and driving off, but resisted because that would only make things worse. Kucha, he was a pulley, a white pulley, settled into the discolored basket of his dreadlocks and fell off to sleep, thinking the threat had passed. Foolishly. But then he was a dog, and dogs had other concerns. Finally, another cruiser appeared, lights flashing, sirens screaming, swooping on up the road behind her like a black steel shroud and nosing in at an angle so close to her front bumper she thought it was going to hit her. In the next instant, she was staring across the passenger seat of this new car and into the face, the hard, demanding, unforgiving, put-upon face of a female officer who picked something up off the seat, squared herself, and swung out of the car. Next thing she knew, both cops were there, one on either side of her, and Kucha was back on his feet, back at it again, barking in a renewed frenzy that just made everything that much harder. "Good afternoon," the female cop said, her eyes roaming over the interior as if she was thinking of making an offer on the car. "I understand that you refused to comply with Officer Switzer's request for identification, is that right?" She said nothing. The female officer, she was tall, thin, no shape to her at all, and she wore no makeup, not a trace, not even lipstick, asked her to get out of the car. Or no, commanded her. She said nothing. "Just to be sure you understand me," the male cop cut in now. He was stationed by the passenger side window, leaning in so he could watch her. And if that didn't make her feel paranoid, she couldn't imagine what would, because this was like being squeezed between two pincers, and it was wrong, intolerable, a violation of every natural right there was. "I have to inform you that state law requires you to show a valid driver's license, registration, and proof of insurance at the reasonable request of a police officer." She threw it right back at him. "Reasonable? You call this reasonable? You have no authority here. You're nothing more to me than a man dressed up in a Halloween costume." "If you refuse," he said, the muscles tightening around his mouth, "we will have no recourse but to remove you forcibly from your vehicle." "Which will be impounded," the female added, as if they'd switched speakers on a stereo, his voice assaulting her on the right, hers on the left. "And your dog will be taken to the shelter." She paused. A top-heavy camper swished delicately past them, 10 miles under the limit. A pickup, going the opposite way, swung with elaborate courtesy off onto the shoulder to give it room, and then continued on in a slow-motion crawl. "And you yourself, if you don't comply this minute, will be arrested. I promise you that, and I personally will escort you to the county jail." It was hopeless. She could see that. The day was ruined. The week, the whole month. This was the megastate in all its glory. She'd stated her status in plain English, and they still didn't seem to understand. Well, they could go to hell, all of them. She started screaming then, calling them every name in the book, shouting TDC, TDC, threat, duress, and coercion over and over again, even as the female forced open the door and took hold of her by the left arm. And Kucha, good dog, faithful dog, went right at her. They took her to the county jail in Ukiah, retracing her route back up Route 20, though now she was in restraints and in the back seat of a police cruiser, separated by a heavy wire grid and plexiglass shield from the female cop, whose right hand, resting at 1 o'clock on the wheel, sported two bright, shining, flesh-colored band-aids where the dog's teeth had broken the skin, though it wasn't much more than a scratch. Her own car was back alongside the road awaiting the tow truck. And Kucha, poor Kucha, after having been poked, prodded, and muzzled by two numbnuts from animal control, had been forced into a boxy white van which must have been somewhere behind her now, on its way up the same road to the animal shelter also in Ukiah. She'd missed her appointment, of course. And for what? For nothing. A seatbelt? And she'd had no way of letting the Burnsides know she wasn't coming, that she'd been unavoidably and illegally detained and wasn't just blowing off her responsibility. And who could blame them if they went online and found another farrier to shoe their horses and trim the hooves of their sable antelope? She had a reputation to maintain, a business to run, and she was doing no harm to anybody, doing nothing more than using the public byways, as was her inalienable right. And now look at the mess she was in. Still, as the cruiser looped through the turns and climbed back up out of the Noyo Valley, she began to rethink her position until, degree by degree, she felt the indignation cooling in her. This was going to cost her. Fines, towing, and Christ knew what else. They'd make her renew that sticker. And there'd be paperwork, a layout of cash she really didn't have, and every sort of hassle the authorities, what a joke, could lay on her. By the time they arrived at the police station and they'd photographed and fingerprinted her, given her one phone call to Christabel, who else, and escorted her to an empty cell and locked her in, she was contrite. Or no, chastened is a better word. And enlightened. Enlightened, too. These people didn't recognize her status. Didn't know a damn thing about the uniform commercial code or her rights under it. And they didn't care, either. They had all the power, all the muscle, and she was nothing, reduced to this, to groveling and ass-kissing and giving lip service to the system, as if she was grateful they'd assaulted her and taken away her rights and her property. All right. If that was how they wanted it, fine. She sat in that cell and kept her mouth firmly shut and fed her hate and resentment till Christabel showed up an hour later with the bail money, and she was out. "I told you," Christabel said once they'd slammed into the pickup in the lot out back of the station. "You may have your theories or beliefs or whatever, but these people, they don't care. They're on another planet. This planet, planet Earth." She gave her a look, all eyeshadow and glistening black mascara. "And you, you're in outer space. I mean it, Sarah. I really do." Christabel was 2 years older than she, also divorced, also childless. She kept her figure and had men sniffing after her 7 days a week. But she was done with men, or that's what she said anyway, at least till the next one came along. She was Sarah's best friend, and here she was proving it all over again, taking time out from her work as a teacher's aide at the elementary school to be there for her. But she was wrong on this. Dead wrong. It's not theory. It's law. Natural law. There you go. I mean, don't you ever learn? They were heading out of the parking lot now, the police lot, and the idiot dinger started in because she wasn't wearing her seatbelt. And buckle your belt, will you? Contrite? Who was contrite? Not her. No, she said. No way. That was when Christabel hit the brakes so hard she nearly went through the window. I swear I'm not going another inch until you buckle up. And not just because of what happened here, and not for safety's sake either, but because I can't stand that fucking noise one more minute. You don't have to shout. I mean, there's nothing wrong with my hearing. Still, she didn't touch the belt. It was as if her hands were paralyzed. The noise kept up. Ding, 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 a beat, then ding, 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 and ding, ding, ding. Sarah, I'm warning you. I mean it. I do. She let her gaze roll on out over the scene. She was calm now, utterly calm. Traffic flicked by on the street. Ding, ding, ding. Ding, ding, ding. A girl who honestly couldn't have been more than 16 went by pushing one of those double baby strollers as if there was nothing wrong with that, as if that was the way people were supposed to live. She looked over her shoulder and saw that there was a car in the lot behind them, a face trapped in the blaze of the windshield, some other soul trying to get out of this purgatory and back to real life. But nobody was going anywhere unless something changed right here and now. Christabel was glaring at her, actually glaring. In the next moment, and she hardly knew what she was doing, she flipped the handle and pushed the door open wide, and then she was out on the sidewalk, her feet moving and the door gaping behind her, hurrying down the street as fast as her boots would take her, thinking, the bank. Gotta get to the bank before it closes. And Christabel? Christabel was just an afterthought, because she wasn't going to sit there arguing. She had to get to the bank because she knew she was going to have to suck everything out of her savings and put it into a cashier's check if she was going to get the car out of hock. That was her first priority. The car, because without it, she was stuck. Once she had it back, the minute they handed her the keys, she'd head straight to the animal shelter, because when she thought about how scared and hurt and confused that dog must have been, it just made her heart seize. He'd never been separated from her since she'd got him as a pup. Never, not even for a single day. And what had he done? Just defend her, that was all. And now he was locked up in a concrete pen with a bunch of strays and pit bulls and God knew what else. She didn't care what anybody said. And they could go ahead and crucify her. But that was as wrong got. Thanks. Thank you. So that's Sarah. I can't resist telling you just a little bit of what happens next. I'd love to read it to you, but they tell me we have to leave here by 1 this morning, so we won't have time. So, she's outraged that they have the dog. He's got to be quarantined for 30 days because, of course, she doesn't have a rabies certificate. And he bit the cop. And so she's going back up Route 20 in her own car the next day, and she sees this guy hitchhiking. It's Adam. He's 25. He's very muscular. He's got a shaved head. He's wearing fatigues. And she picks him up. And he's very, very strange. Very strange. But at some point, a cop car goes by. And he hangs out the window, giving them the finger and shouting, fuck you, you know, like this. And she realizes, well, he's a little extreme, but they have something in common. So they make a deal. And the deal is he is going to the Big Five in Ukiah. He's got a buddy who works there who gives him stuff kind of for free under the table. And he is planning to live permanently in the woods. So he's got a bunker out there. He's growing a crop of poppies. And he needs equipment. So this guy lets him for very cheaply have, you know, the freeze-dried dinners that he likes to eat and the big knife and all of this. Sarah says she'll take him there if he'll do something for her, and that is go to the animal shelter. Adam goes in, distracts the person at the desk. Sarah sneaks in and steals the dog back, after which they're both on the lam. So that's how it goes. And I should tell you about the research for this particular part of this story. So I went to the Ukiah Animal Shelter with my wife, and My wife, I should say, was born without a soul. So she can see anything. It doesn't affect her. I am extremely sensitive. I don't want to see it. I just have to think it, and my imagination is on fire. So we walk in, and it's a big, elegant, nice place. And you walk in, and on the right are the cats. And the cats are tricked out in these little cages that are really hammocks, and they have cute names and little things, because nobody wants the cats, you know? So there they are, the cats. Then you go and open the door, and the urine stench hits you, and there are all the dogs. There's like 50 dogs. They're all beautiful. They're all dying to get out, and they're all doomed, and my heart is breaking. I had 10 seconds, and I was out of there. My wife blithely walks through and, you know, pets the dogs and so on. Meanwhile, in my confusion and hurt, I walk around back of the place, and there was the furnace. So that's research, folks. I think it's time to open this up for your questions and comments.
I thought you didn't want to depress us.
The question or comment is, I thought you didn't want to depress us. I'm depressing you, but with good humor. Okay? There's a difference. Yes. Okay, great. Great question. She has read the book. She wants to know more of the research I did on Adam. But first, why don't you and I discuss the ending in detail? this is the second time I've written about a schizophrenic. The first is Stanley McCormick of Riven Rock. Stanley McCormick was the errant son of Cyrus McCormick, the guy who invented the mechanical reaper, which became International Harvester, etc. So the very wealthy turn of the last century. Riven Rock is in the neighborhood where I live. It's a big mansion they built for their family. Stanley became schizophrenic in his late 20s, just after he married. And he had to be locked up in that place for 22 years, not allowed to see a woman. He took his anger out on women, would attack any woman on sight. He was a big man, powerful man, over 6 feet tall and strong. So they had to lock him up. I had access to the complete psychiatric record of Stanley. It's like this big, so that even the visions he sees in that book are true to the fact. In this case, I am, as in that case too, I am drawing on a close friend of mine I grew up with who became schizophrenic in our late teens and was gone from us thereafter. I call him Casper in a couple of short stories and in a piece I wrote for BuzzFeed, which is up there right now, about my relationship with this man. We grew up together. I loved him. He was a genius. He was great. But he became increasingly delusional, and he had so many wonderful, unusual ideas that I kind of loved. We all knew that he was a little squirrely, but who isn't, you know? And it was beautiful, and I loved him. And he was also very much an outdoors guy, you know? Unfortunately, he drifted off into oblivion, but not before becoming the parents' worst nightmare, aside from killing somebody. When he was, 16, his parents made him a little room in the basement, little apartment, and what he did down there was he lifted weights all the time and drank quarts of milk so he could get protein for his musculature, and he would listen to Lead Belly records all the time, just Lead Belly, and lift his weights and so on. And he made his own clothes out of leather that were ridiculous clothes that, you know, he got kicked out of school every day for violating a dress code, et cetera, et cetera. It's just the beginning of what he was like. 10 years later, he was still living in the basement, listening to Lead Belly, lifting weights, and drinking quarts of milk. And he became increasingly delusional until, you know, even we couldn't ever talk to him again. So I'm really thinking of him when I think of Adam. Also, this 50-page police report tells what the real character did. So, for instance, he considered the Chinese to all be against him. All the Chinese in the world were against him, and they were the new aliens, just like the Indians of the Old West. And the actual guy, actually went to the consulate in San Francisco and threw over these Chinese stars he'd made out of cardboard with shiny paper on them and little notes to them, little apocryphal notes, and threw them over. That's not the right word. Bizarre notes, and threw them over, and he was arrested for this. So I took some of those details and then tried to envision the world through his eyes. Well, you know this already. You've read the book. Yes.
Can you talk about culture and how it is inserted into that whole story and in the story?
Yeah, perfect timing for that question. She wants me to talk about Coulter and how he's inserted in the story. We paid her $100 to sit there and ask that question, by the way. Again, I work very instinctively, intuitively. I'm just moving, you know, day by day in this kind of dream I'm in, and it all kind of falls together. So what is this book about? You know, I, as I said to you earlier, when I created Sarah, I realized it's about this anti-authoritarian streak that we all have. But also, in a deeper way, there is a quote here that opens the book from D.H. Lawrence's Studies in Classic American Literature. "The essential American soul is hard, isolate, stoic, and a killer. It has never yet melted." Well, that's a proposition. You know, is that true? The harder they come, the harder they fall. It's a challenge. You know, is that true? And so I'm, you know, involved in this and writing along, and I realized that maybe there's an historical context, too. We are a young country. We're a country that started with utopian communities. Don't tread on me. You know, we don't want to have bosses or overseers or laws. Who wants to be, you know, part of a society like that? And so I remember the story of John Coulter from elementary school, and many of you will know this. John Coulter was an early mountain man, so early 19th century. And he was going west of the Mississippi into Indian territory to trap beaver. Beaver then were used to make felt for the top hats that all the men wore in London, Paris, and Boston, and New York, and so on. And the Indians, obviously, were a little upset with his trespass. And they caught him one day, killed his companion, stripped him naked in the middle of the village, and then spent some time debating how best to torture him to death. You know, should they strip off his skin and make him eat it, set him on fire? What are they going to do? So on this particular day, they thought they'd have a kind of human fox hunt. So he's naked with no shoes on. And they gave him a 100-yard head start, and the swiftest young braves with their spears ran after him to kill him. But he had great incentive. And he outran them and got away, which is why we're talking about him today. So Adam fixates on him. He's his hero. He even calls himself Coulter. He wants to be just like this. And the sections on Coulter are interesting for me because I'm giving you the real history from the history books in a vocabulary that Adam might not have had otherwise, but he is aping what the books say. But I'm always careful to remind you that this is Adam's version of who Coulter was. And so we get a kind of historical perspective on this gun violence as well. There was a time when there was Indian territory where people, like some of these deranged youth, might have had some place to go be by themselves and do whatever they're going to do and maybe commit acts of violence, but not against us in our society. So it just enabled me to broaden the scope of what I was doing. Others? Yes, in the back. The question is, she thinks I'm very productive, and how do I do it? Do I wake up at night and write? No. All things in their place. I met the late John Gardner when I was in the first year at USC. He came and gave a reading, and I loved his work, and I loved him. Brilliant, amazing guy. And he told me this, which is horrible. He claimed that he got up at 7 in the morning and worked till 11 at night. Now, that is like a prison sentence. That is crazy. We all know from having written term papers that if you know from 7 in the morning to 11 at night that you're going to have all this time to work, well, you don't do anything. You just worry until 10:30, then you work for half an hour, you know? So I try to have a more rational attitude. I'm an artist. This is my life. This is what I do every day, 7 days a week. I get up early, clean up after my wife, of course, read two newspapers, you know, sob for about half an hour, and then go to work. And I am done maybe by 2 or 3, depending on the day or what state of a book I'm in. And then I try to go outside. I shut everything mechanical off, phone, computers, Twitter, whatever it is. I don't care. I don't want to see it. I don't want to hear about it till the next day. So, too, with the writing. Maybe I am thinking about it on an unconscious level, but I think that time, I spend a lot of time in the Sierras. When I'm in the mountains, I just go out and with a dog and a book and go for a hike and read a book in the woods, winter and summer. At home, of course, like all of you, you have the hassles of keeping the house from falling down and all of that. But I didn't even think about it till the next day. And then I'd rewrite what I've done before, I'd rewrite it, and try to get back into that dream. So, a couple more? Yes?
Do you have a favorite book?
Do I have a favorite book? I'm asked every night that I've written. I'm asked every night, so I have decided that it's going to be Water Music, which is my first. I didn't know if I could write a novel. This is a wild first novel of 550 pages about Mungo Park's explorations in Africa in 1795 to 1805. It's completely wild. I'm not saying that I won't write something as wild again, but I don't know. So I'm going to go back as a sentimental favorite. That's the first, and that's how you learn how to write. You write it. A couple more. Yes. Yes. The question is, I write stories as well, and do I know if what I'm writing is a story or a novel? Yes, I do. I've never had the experience of taking a longer thing and making it into a story or vice versa. I'm very single-minded. I just do one thing at a time, and I focus on that because I'm afraid if I don't, I get distracted and won't finish. So I will write a novel, usually a longer historical novel, than half a book of stories, then a shorter, more contemporary novel like this one, and then another half book of stories, and on and on. That's sort of been the rhythm I've been on, and it's worked really well for me. Yes?
The section that you read, it's written in the third person, but it almost feels like the first person.
Yeah. Okay, so the question here is, and we also, by the way, paid this guy $100 to ask that question. It's written in a third person, but it feels like first person because this is a very, very close third person. You're right inside her. This is how the whole book is written. You're right inside these three characters. And what is that like, and how does that work? In this case, just the way you've heard it. It could almost be a first person because you're so deeply inside her. That brings me to the novel that I'm halfway through and worked frantically to get completely finished, perfect first half before I came on this tour. There are three first-person narrators. I've never quite tried that before. I want to see how it goes. Two women and one man. They're telling you the same story. I did this. I was here. I saw her. How does that work? And so far, it seems to be working pretty well. And by the way, this is the story called The Terranauts. A new novel called Terranauts. It's set in the early 90s, and it is a fictional recreation of the biosphere experiment where in Arizona where, see, it's good stuff. 3,800 species were enclosed inside a 3-acre compound, glassed in like a big greenhouse. Plants and animals, 3,800 species, four men, four women, locked inside, sealed inside for 2 years. Could we create another biosphere beyond the one we live in? How does that work? Can it be self-generating in the event that this one collapses and we had to make our own biosphere or a Mars station or whatever? It's a lot of fun, these three narrators, narrators. And I'm halfway through, and I didn't realize at the outset how incredibly sexy it is. Four men, four women locked inside for 2 years. What are they going to do? So it's also comedic. It's comedic, but, again, it goes back to my green themes and the whole environmental thing as well. And I think if I'm able to finish it, and I think I will be by the end of the year, I hope you'll enjoy that one too. So just a couple more. Yes. Yeah.
And then do you necessarily know how it's going to end, or do you start going like this book you're talking about, the new book? Do you really know how it's going to end, or do you just goes?
Yeah. The question is, I start with a concept, and do I know how it's going to end? No, I don't really. That is the magic of fiction. It's why I only write fiction. I am exploring. I'm finding out. Now, with the Terranauts, I know what's going to happen just next, and I have a vague idea of how this might play out in the second year of closure. The first part is called reentry. The second part is first year of closure. Then there's pre-closure, First year, second year, and reentry. And so I know that there will be those four parts, but I don't know exactly how it will play out until I get there. I mean, that's sort of the magic of doing it. It's why I love to do it so much. I don't know. I'm discovering day by day. Yes? Yeah, good question. The question is, do I ever have a character, maybe a minor character in a book, and would I then think, well, I like this character, should I take her or him and enlarge him into their own story? I haven't really done that or done any sequels either, I think because I'm too curious about what's next. I'm always moving forward. So, for instance, fall a year ago, I just published T.C. Boyle Stories 2, the huge monumental collected stories, the second volume. And my hero in this is John Updike, who has died before he published the second volume, but he published his first volume with a preface. And he said in his preface that he reread all of his old stories and he couldn't resist rewriting them. I would never do that. I don't want to rewrite them. I don't. I mean, they are part of an historical period. They're done. I'm pleased with them. That's the way they are. Maybe I would write those concepts slightly differently now, but I don't care about that. I want to move forward. So those are the stories as they appeared. Yes?
You mentioned John Gardner. Do you have other favorite authors?
Oh, I have thousands of favorite authors. The question is, do I have other favorite authors? Yes, I have thousands of them. What are my top two or three? Well, this would change every night. I love Kazuo Ishiguro, who's been bouncing around here on tour with his new book, which I have, but I haven't read yet because it's heavy. And all I have is a bag over each shoulder full of dirty underwear, you know. I love Garcia Marquez, Dennis Johnson, there are millions and millions of them. Richard Ford. I know most of my fellow writers, of course. Martin Amis. There are just so many great writers out there right now. Yes.
On satire and the pen recognition of Charlie Hebdo,
please. My thoughts on satire and Charlie Hebdo. I'm known a lot as a satirist, and my natural way of dealing with the world is to make crazy, sick jokes to keep from crying. You know, I mean, this is what satire does for me. And I branched out. I want to write everything that I can, including straightforward drama. As I began doing, I guess, 20 years ago. But prior to that, I'd only been a satirist. And what about Charlie Hebdo? Well, in a very unique twist, this book had its world premiere in German before in English. And that's because I'd had five books 5 years in a row. We held this one back. And the Germans, meanwhile, jumped on it and published in February. So I was over there in Europe when the Copenhagen attacks had gone on, and shortly after Charlie Hebdo. And, of course, the relation is the same. It's an attack on our democratic society and on our ability to live together. I stand for absolute freedom of expression, no matter what it takes. I don't know if I would have had the courage of the editor of Charlie Hebdo, but I think if a group, any group, and we go back to Salman Rushdie and the Ayatollah, starts to dictate what we can and cannot say in our country, we're doomed. So I admire the courage of this guy, a kind of fatal courage, a kind of suicidal courage. But I think I'm standing here before you. I'm proud to be part of a democracy and able to be who I am and say anything I want and do anything I want without having to care about anything. I mean, that's our essential freedom. And so, like Adam, you know, who admires Coulter, because Coulter never had to say yes sir, captain, to no man, you know, I feel the same way. And I think most of us do. Again, the question is, where do you decide that we can all sit here tonight instead wearing clothes instead of being naked and raping and eating each other? It's because we want to have a society, and we agree to give up some freedoms so that everybody can share in these freedoms. Go to the nearest park tonight And there would be a list of prohibitions when you walk through the gate, you know. No jumping from the bridge, no smoking, no setting your hair on fire, no dogs, no fun, no breathing the air. And, you know, immediately I want to jump from the bridge. I didn't have that idea before, but, you know, the nanny state. I mean, all of us have a problem with it. But again, this book is kind of meditating on where do we draw the line? And can we let any particular group silence us? And I say no, we can't. So one or two more and then we'll hang it up. By the way, I'm not running for office yet. Yeah. Yes.
I just wonder why that work's important to you and why you continue to do
it. The question is, she understands I'm also a professor and a teacher. Why is that work important to me and why do I continue to do it? Again, I've been very lucky to live in this society and be able to do exactly what I want my whole life. So I don't work in films. I've never had any interest in that, even though lots of my stuff have been made into films. I love films. I just want to work individually. But I had great mentors throughout. I come from a working class family. I'm the first of our family ever to go to college. I had great teachers. I can name them. Even, like, I love to perform here because I had an eighth grade teacher, Donald Grant, who was an amateur actor. And he would read aloud to us on Fridays if we were good. And, of course, we mostly were good. You know, the old chestnuts like To Build a Fire and The Most Dangerous Game and The Monkey's Paw. And I would go out of that room trembling. And it was a great thing. So I think of him. And I think of my mother's voice in my head, too. She's the one who taught me to read. You know, I was a very, very squirrely kid. It probably had, you know, there would be an ADD attached to it today and a shrink and everything else. In those days, we didn't have that. We just had a back door. So I spent most of my life outside. So I want to give back. I had great mentors all the way through you know, my MFA and my PhD and on and on. And I love literature. I love to keep it alive. That's why I love to see you here. And I particularly love to go to colleges and turn on with a show, the young men who only know literature as some horrible thing that they have to do to write a paper in school and not as a subversive pleasure, which it is. That's what we're doing here tonight. It's great to hear a story aloud. I love it. I'm a big fan of books on tape, for instance. So, yeah, I've chosen to do it, and I love to do it, and I'm pleased and proud to have had so many students over the years who may or may not go into the profession of writing. Some are famous writers today. Some, you know, are sitting on the street with very creative signs begging for change. And there's one guy from the early years when I first started at USC, which would be late 70s, early 80s. I will call him Steve. And Steve, you know, he had some problems, but he was a good writer, a good writer. And, you know, he took the course. He took four courses with me, and I loved him. And he got a scholarship to NYU, to grad school, and so on and so on. And then I would see him in New York for years thereafter, and he didn't have a job. And he would say to me, "Well, you ruined my life." And I would say, "Hey, Steve, that's a great compliment. How often do you get to ruin somebody's life?" Okay, so I'll be happy to sign all your books and meet you individually. Thanks so much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.